of this segment, jump right on in and speak with Colonel Dick Kemp, United States Marine Corps author, who has obviously tremendous amount to share with us today. And Colonel Kemp, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, no, thank you. It's my pleasure.
It's an emotional day. There's no doubt about it. You chronicle so much in regard to military service, Leatherneck Legend, with conversations with the Marine Corps old breed. Can we just chat about this for just a few moments?
Sure.
Would you mind? Before we do, would you mind a little background information on yourself before we jump in?
All right, just a little bit. I served 26 years in the Corps, retired as a colonel, and I'm now the Deputy Director of History Division at the Marine Corps University of Quantico, Virginia.
Very nicely done, sir. Tell us about Leatherneck Legends.
Well, Leatherneck Legends is a book about five general officers, three of which I knew personally, and it chronicles their history in combat through World War I all the way through Vietnam.
All the way through Vietnam?
Yes. Now, not all of them served from
right.
World War I to Vietnam, needless to say.
Absolutely. How was the selection of these five individuals made?
Well, mostly based on my personal experience, I was an aide-de-camp to General Ray Davis, who was a Medal of Honor winner from Korea, and also General Shepard, who was a former commandant and a World War I Marine. General Craig was a personal friend of mine who served in World War I and then Korea in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to have an aviator in there. You have to have a duty aviator, so I picked General Geiger, who is one of the more famous Marine aviators.
What if we take each gentleman and briefly give us maybe a synopsis of what really differentiated them from all others? We start with Len Shepard.
Well, I'd like to say that there were some differences, but I will tell you this, that their combat leadership
mm-hmm.
made them all similar, because they were men who were not only were fearless in combat, but also knew how to lead men in difficult situations. Every one of them, from World War I all the way through Vietnam.
Right.
And so they were more similar than dissimilar, I will tell you that.
Very good. The opportunity to purchase the book, we want folks to be able to find a copy where Amazon? Or
yes, you can go to Amazon.
And also local bookstores,
yes,
perhaps,
yes,
even
as well.
Yes,
that's correct.
The this is a labor of love as a historian.
Right. It is, because I knew them personally, and in my position now as the Deputy Director History Division, it really brings it all home, because we have the records that chronicle their story.
Fantastic. Battleship Arizona's Marines at War.
Great. I was glad. I hope you're getting
I'm
there.
I'm getting right there.
All right, all right.
This was a compelling work as well. So, but today is the day, and Marines at War.
Yes. And this was truly a labor of love. I came here about a year ago, and visiting Arizona, and I had always thought about the Marine detachment on board, because most of them are still on board. And I wanted to chronicle their story. So I woke up one morning and said, I'm going to write a book about the Marine detachment. And fortunately ran into Pat Brent, and he said that the former commanding officer of the Marine detachment still lives in Honolulu. So I contacted him, Colonel Jack Earl, really a fine gent, a great Marine, and then did a lot of research and talked to the other Marine survivor, who is the only Marine to that was on board Arizona when she was sunk. And from there, we came to this. Jack is a great guy, chronicles the story. He took over on the 6th of December.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, that's what I say.
Holy smokes.
And he was on the Tennessee. Came off the Tennessee late in the afternoon of the 6th December and got with the old commanding officer, and they were doing an inventory of the Marine equipment. About 10 o'clock that night, the former CO said, well, Jack, I'm thirsty. Let's go for a beer. They went in the officers' club, and while they were there, the CO said, well, look, Jack, why don't you go home to your family?
Oh.
And so he did, and he was going to return the next morning.
Right.
Needless to say, it probably saved his life.
Amen.
And but there's great stories in there of tremendous bravery, and this only chronicles the Marines on board, and obviously there were a tremendous number of other services here, and I don't want to downplay their role.
But I think the effort that you're making is is very valuable because not many people understand that Marines were serving on board at the time. And describe what their role and responsibility was on board.
On the detachment on board Arizona basically manned the secondary battery, which were about six guns along the gun deck in casemates. And of course, they could not, they had no vertical ability, and so they could not be used as anti-aircraft guns. So basically, when general quarters sounded, the Marines went to their general quarters station. Most of them went into the casemates along the side. But there were 15 Marines that were in secondary aft, which was about 100 feet over the main deck. And when general quarters sounded, they ran up the outside of the leg of the tripod, of course, exposed to shrapnel and bullets from the Japanese aircraft. The lead man was a Lieutenant Simonson. And as he reached the searchlight platform, a bomb exploded and hit him in the chest and stomach, and lay there dying as all the Marines passed by him. And the word is that he was so badly injured that he couldn't talk, but he mumbled, "Go on to your duty station, leave me be." They went up to the secondary aft, and of course, within a very few minutes, the Japanese bomb went between number one and number two turret, exploded the powder magazine down there. The force of the explosion went vertically as well as horizontally, wiped out all the crews in the casemates, but saved the secondary aft because it was protected basically from the bridge. The bridge took the force of the explosion. At that point, the senior officer, which was a Captain Shapley, said, "Men, it's every man for himself. God bless you and good luck." And they all came down the tripod onto the boat deck. And I've talked to the one survivor, and he said there was an apparition leaning against one of the ventilator shafts. It was a man who was all his clothes burned off, blackened, skin hanging in shreds. And the guy mumbled something. He said, "My God, First Sergeant." It was the first sergeant of the detachment, and literally died within a few minutes. Indicated that there were, looked like logs, burnt logs lying all over, and those were the sailors and Marines that were able to make it out. Many of the men staggered out of this terrific flame, literally dead, but their bodies had not just shut down and fell dead. The men then, as the signal was given by the commander to abandon ship, of course, went into the water and tried to make it to Ford Island. Shapley, who was the former detachment CO, saved another Marine because he was drowning and was able to pull him to Ford Island, but the survivors went into a bunker. And before the second wave came in, and that's where Jack Earl roared up in a taxi. By the way, he came in on a taxi and went over to Merry Point Landing, which is still in existence. And as he got on board the landing, he saw a Japanese torpedo lying there. And the boats were coming up, and as they would announce, they'd yell out, "Colorado, Nevada." No boat came in from Arizona. So he knew then that, and of course he could look across and see these tremendous flames and smoke curling up, just shooting up from the battleship row. Japanese aircraft were still in the air. Made his way to Ford Island, ran into the detachment who were taking shelter in a bunker. Most of them had no clothes on, either was blown off or took it off getting into the water. And then tried to, and they were several of them were in shock. But he said there were literally dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds of sailors who were badly burned, just staggering around Ford Island looking for shelter, looking for medical treatment, many of them in shock. And, of course, the tremendous damage, not only on Ford Island, but all along Battleship Row. As you know, Colorado turned over. In fact, last night I was talking to a water tender second class who was able to get out of one of the portholes. And as he said, as he got out, his chief was pushing sailors out through this porthole, but the chief was too big and couldn't make it himself. So literally saved all those men. But tremendous bravery and devotion to duty. Sailors were trying to rescue people in the water. Water was burning in places from the fuel oil that spilled from the ship. Just a tremendous scene of devastation at that time.
There's one part that stands out, and not to be flippant about it, but the fact that Jack Earl could find a chasm to take him here while we're under attack. I know that sounds a little strange, but to me that just kind of
Right. In fact,
that's it. I don't
well,
know.
Well, in fact, I think it's the cab company that's still here.
Is that right?
Charlie's Cab Company. Charlie.
No kidding.
Yeah, that's my understanding.
Well, Dale Evans, I know you listen. Good for you.
That's right.
He made a
sure. point at the gate. Of course, at that time, the Marines were manning the gates, and they were very, very suspicious of anybody coming aboard. In fact, there was a naval officer named Lee who looked Japanese, and they were giving him a hard time getting in, and he was trying to say, oh, look, I'm a Naval Academy graduate, showing him his ID card and the whole thing, shooting match, and the Marines were not really having a lot of that at that particular point in time.
Yeah.
But just as you listen to the old-timers talk about their experiences and trying to put yourself back in paradise mm-hmm. on a Sunday morning when all you're thinking about is the beautiful weather here in Hawaii and going ashore for liberty, and all of a sudden the world caves in on you. And those men who reacted well, who manned the guns, who tried to defend themselves in the harbor, my hat goes off to them.
I wish we had a lot more time with you today, Colonel, but before we do go, and I'm glad you're framing this in that way. For those of us who weren't born at the time of World War II and who did not live through this attack, framing it in contemporary America, not only the importance of December 7th, but if we use a historical frame of what we're enduring today, the situation with our war on terror, can we do that?
That's a hard one. Well, certainly 9/11 was something similar, that it was a wake-up call for the country that there are people out there who just absolutely hate America and what we stand for. And the men and women who are in Iraq right now, I think you can certainly look at them as defending this country and all that we believe in, and they're doing it to a great job. In my position, I deploy historians and combat artists to Iraq. And these are reservists who come in, who give up their jobs, who go in harm's way for the same reason, to protect this country and to chronicle the stories of bravery over there. So I don't know whether that really equates it or not, but certainly we're in a war. And I think that those of us who don't think we're in a war had better wake up.
Into that. Is there a way that our listeners would be able to contact you in some way by email, or what would be the best way?
Sure. I'm located at Quantico, Virginia. My email address is richard.camp, C-A-M-P, at usmc.mil, M-I-L.
Amen to that. Amen. Colonel, fantastic.
Oh,
thank you
pleasure.
So very
thank
much.
You. Yes, sir.
Thank you. We'll be back with more of the Rick Amato program from Pearl Harbor in just a moment.